It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps.
That's too long.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
My chair creaked, so I'm going to do that again. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge.
This is To the Best of Our Knowledge.
Hi, everyone. It's Anne.
It's Anne.
It's Anne. Anne Strainchamps.
I'll give you a
take two on that.
Retake.
Welcome to the Best of Our Knowledge.
To the Best of Our Knowledge.
Okay. I'm going to give you that one again.
I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this...
Strainchamps.
You are listening.
We'll do that once more. I'm going to do that one more.
Slow down.
Sorry this has taken so long. So here, I'll tell you the story that I was going to begin with, which is that 2 hours ago, I was sitting in front of my computer and I was trying to put my thoughts together for this conversation. And I was having a hard time focusing. And the minutes were ticking by and I was feeling increasingly anxious, kind of incompetent, panicky, ashamed, you know, this whole tide of toxic emotions. And then I thought, well, maybe that's as good a place to begin as any.
Yeah, I love that, especially because that's kind of how I started.
This is Jenny Odell, a writer who knows what it's like to feel anxious about time. What's an example for you of time feeling painful?
I mean, there's like the everyday granular sense, and then there's the big sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, that report came out about climate change, and like I really felt the sense of time running out. That's like a big sort of existential feeling. And then there's the very small everyday, which is like I'm someone who takes a lot of public transportation, and I feel like I'm always running after buses. I'm always running after buses and trains. And then I'm often thinking about the person who's waiting for me on the other side and how I'm wasting their time.
Yeah.
And I think about every minute of them sitting there waiting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had the same anxiety dream for my entire life, which is that I'm running out of time.
Mm.
Some version of I'm late or I'm not prepared for something. Time is my enemy. I think I first really noticed it after the 2016 election. I felt like my trains of thought were really short. There was this kind of urgency all the time, always needing to check in. There's an assumption that something has always happened in the few seconds that you've been away. You're always coming back and reacting and then checking back for more. And I also felt on a physical level like I was living in constant fight or flight, constantly sort of bracing for an impact that was gonna come. That's an unsustainable way to live, you know? It's actually really bad for you. I remember just thinking like, this feels bad. And I want to try to find a way out of this. And I also want to understand why.
Welcome to the Best of Our Knowledge and the Center for Humans and Nature. Welcome to Deep Time, Episode 1, The Tyranny of Time. So I came across an article the other day with a title that kind of stopped me in my tracks. You ready? There are 10,080 minutes in a week. Here's how to be the boss of all of them. That turns out to be a line from a Microsoft VP who invented a time management technique called time boxing. which I guess is meant to help people set priorities and take control of their lives. But to me, it's a perfect illustration of something deeply wrong about our relationship with time. When did time become money? Why do we think faster is better? And how did we decide that learning to chop our days into minutes and seconds is a good way to live? This is what Jenny Odell decided to investigate in two books, the first called How to Do Nothing, the second called Saving Time, in which she traces a direct line from the invention of clocks to the kind of efficiency software that monitors remote workers' keystrokes, counts warehouse workers' steps, and times their bathroom breaks.
It's a very painful history to revisit because there's so much coercion and you really see this struggle and loss of power on the part of workers. It's not even just necessarily that people are having to work faster, but that time is so minutely broken up and orchestrated. I'm just thinking about the interfaces that people use in call centers, right? How choreographed that is. The actions that you're supposed to take and the order that you're supposed to do them in and how little downtime you're given. And then the fact that a lot of them will use competitive leaderboards for everyone who's there, like showing different people's progress. And it's just extremely micromanaged. You know, it was striking to me how the Charlie Chaplin film, Modern Times, where he's on the assembly line trying to keep up, you know, it feels historical. And then as I was looking at more contemporary examples, it was sort of like, oh, this is alive and well.
I've never actually seen Modern Times.
Oh, it's great. I highly recommend it. Yeah. Yeah.
What's your favorite scene?
My favorite scene is by far, I should preface this by saying that I am a person who really appreciates dark humor. There's a scene where a sort of salesperson shows up at the factory with this new innovation called the feeding machine, which is supposed to eliminate the lunch hour.
Oh my God.
By feeding a worker without them having to move. And so Charlie Chaplin's character is the guinea pig for the demo. And it's a rotating platter of different foods. It's like a bowl of soup. And I can't remember what the other foods are, but there's a corn cob spinner. It's mechanical, right? So it's like spinning the corn so that you don't have to move your body or your head. But it starts malfunctioning and going too fast, slamming the corn cob into his face over and over again.
Jenny, this is just what we were talking about.
Yeah.
But this is what I love about the work you're doing, kind of historicizing the time sense that we live inside and that by now we've all completely internalized. How far back do you in your head go when you want to tell the history of how time got quantified and commodified? Like, where's a starting point for you?
I went back to the monks, European monks, the Cistercian monks in particular, who I think in their activities and the way they organize things, you can start to see like a kind of obsession with punctuality. And it was very tied to the idea of labor hours, counting the hours of work that people were doing.
You write some about how quantified time wound up getting exported around the world by colonists.
Yeah, there's a really great account of that process that's specific to British colonies called the colonization of time. So you have European, or in this case, British colonists showing up with this idea that there is something morally good about the idea of regular work hours and a Sabbath punctuated week. And they look around and what they see is people who have no sense of time, this idea of the timeless native, right? Mm-hmm. But obviously there was like a fully formed sense of time there already that was just not what they thought of as being time. There's this amazing passage that he quotes. I think it's a missionary's daughter who's writing home to Britain saying, our clocks just arrived. We got here and we didn't have any clocks and the chronometer stopped working. So we've been living without time, you know? And she says, it's very comforting to hear the tick, tick and the ding, ding.
Wow. But it's fascinating how, I guess, morality is built into this sense of time around then too, because it's so linked to Christian missionaries. And if you see the rest of the world as unsaved and you think you're showing up to save them with the Bible and the clock.
Yeah, right. It's kind of seen as like a civilizing force or something like that. In that same book, The Colonization of Time, he quotes a mission publication where they have this long paragraph. It's basically cultural propaganda that's like, how many hours do you have in God's bank?
Whoa.
And it's all that language just mixed together. It's at once economic and moral. Wow. So it's something that you also see in the Protestant work ethic where it's like, yeah, you're supposed to work really hard mm-hmm. to make a lot of money, but that's not so that you can then spend that money. It's because it's just actually a moral religious imperative to work really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And the money is considered God's money. It's not even really yours.
I don't know. That just says so much about psychological attitudes toward time that are so deeply part of my makeup. I don't know how to get rid of them.
I mean, it's hard. It's
no, I think it is so liberating to see where that idea came from and to watch it form, because it kind of frees you from feeling like, oh, I'm just a bad person because I spent the entire morning sitting on my couch knitting. And, you know, I should have been doing something more worthwhile.
Yeah. When I have that feeling, I'm like, worth it to who? I don't know. I'm morbidly fascinated by thinking about how that culturally and historically specific way of thinking sort of moved inside. It's now the thing that I see when I look in the mirror on a very personal level.
Yeah. How do you think that happened? Because I was trying to think about that, and I was thinking, I suddenly felt intensely guilty for having ever sent my kids to school. I mean, they're now grown up. They're ruined already. But I kind of felt like, oh, my God, that is what the public school system does. It teaches us how to live on factory time. I mean, kindergarten, you have a child whose time is relatively unstructured or naturally structured. You know, mm-hmm. I'm hungry or it's time for bed. And suddenly you break their day up into arbitrary 45-minute long periods and a bell rings. It's like breaking a horse.
Yeah, it is. It is. As you know, like I have that part of the book where it's like a report card that I made for myself as a very young child who can barely write.
Like, oh my God, I forgot that.
That's how much I internalized that system of performance and evaluation. And I remember learning like fast is good.
Yeah.
Fast and accurate, like a machine.
Mm. So I wanted to ask about the relationship between our sense of time and climate change, because you do make a connection to climate change as being an outgrowth of the kind of time that our culture created.
Yeah. It's difficult to encapsulate. And I think the best way that I found to describe it is like for a person alive now, right? It's very easy to feel squeezed between two feelings about time that seem deeply unrelated. And one is I'm working against the clock and I'm running out of time and I'm trying to be more productive. And then the other is you're looking out the window and the sort of climate clock is getting more and more out of whack. And there's a sense of time running out on that scale, which feels very different. It's like the moment that I describe in the book of when the skies were red here in the Bay Area from the wildfires, and it was actually getting darker between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m., and I'm sitting at my desk working, and I can see my neighbor across the street working. We're on work time as this other thing is playing out outside that we can both see, right? And that's not a good feeling.
Since reading your book, I've been trying to not live within just one form of time, not having mono time, trying to, I don't know, go for a walk and think about the layers and layers of earth and rock under my feet and try to think my way a little bit into geological time. Maybe it's like learning other languages, so I'm not just speaking one. That feels healthier.
Yeah, it sounds like you're living the term that I use in the book, chronodiversity.
I like that.
Right? I don't think I'm the first person to have used that word, but it is like speaking different languages or having a different lens. Mm. On realities. It feels better, but it also, for me personally, has been a source of inspiration. I mean, it's spring right now, right? Like the buckeye tree that I talk about in the book as kind of my personal clock is very active right now. The leaves have come back. There is a cycle, but these leaves are not the same as last year's leaves that kind of, it almost like reawakens the possibility that I could do something new, that I could do something unexpected and I could respond to the moment that I'm in a new way, because there's so much right now that can make you feel like we're just kind of in it to the end.
I have this voice in my head that just keeps saying, ask her about death. So I think I need to ask you about death.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we talked about how it's this historical construct that we all have this feeling that we're running out of time, except that, of course, humans are the only animal that are aware that we are literally running out of time. You know, we will all face an end date.
Yeah, I think it's very related in the fact that one of the, I think, corollaries to this notion of squeezing value out of your time is the notion that your life is like a product that you could get more or less value out of. If you're not doing it right, you're not getting enough value out of it. And I think that's a notion that's very tied to individual achievement and productivity, not so much to the sense of like connection or encounter or being changed by something. And so, yeah, I do have a chapter where I kind of talk about death, and I honestly think about this story all the time still. The children's story that has haunted me ever since I read it, about the young boy who is given a ball by a witch, and then if he pulls the thread out of it, time will go faster. But the thread can only be pulled out. It can't be put back in. So he predictably pulls it too much because he's impatient to get through his life. And then it's this horror of he's an old man. He never experienced his life. And then the witch luckily comes back and takes the ball away and makes him a young boy again. But I remember
that's
reading
that. That's a terrible story.
It's terrible. And it was I understand the moral was supposed to be like, enjoy your life and be in the moment. But that actually, to me as a child, was just a horror story about the irreversibility of time. You know, so it's just like terrifying. And something, I didn't write this in the book, but because I've been thinking about that story so much, something that I noticed later is the idea of the thread. It's a single thread that belongs to that boy. And if I try to imagine a utopian version of that story, it would be one in which there is no ball. It's just threads that are woven together, because that is actually the reality. My life leaves an impression on other lives. Other lives leave impressions on mine. People who have passed away now like live on in the way that I do things and the way that I think about things. And I think that's how I prefer to think about my life, as being very interwoven with these other lives.
Jenny O'Dell. We were talking about her most recent book, Saving Time, Discovering a Life Beyond the Clock.